interesting memories of Harry and George Skelly roasting a salt herring. The twilight of those winter evenings of many years ago sent a stirring movement through the beings of those two old bachelors who lived at Ballachelly. They were not endowed with those worldly goods, though they owned the house in which they lived, and five small fields, totaling about 7 acres in all. Both the house and the outbuildings, which consisted of a cowshed, stable, a cart shed, loose box, two pigsties, and a hen house, were solidly built of large grey stones bound with lime mortar. Being by the roadside, it looked very clean and impressive. The floor of the living room was of clay, whose surface softened in damp weather. Therefore, a container of dry sand, concealed in a nearby corner, when a few handfuls of the contents would be scattered on the undulating surface. When necessary, a ling besom swelt the trampled area out over the flagged front. There wasn't a back door to this house, which seemed most unusual for a crofter's house of this size, though the smaller homes and thatch cottages rarely had a back door. Although the clay was reasonably solid, little lumps formed here and there, generally where it was squeezed out by continuous traffic, or heavy furniture pressing it to one side. When these rises became too prominent, a sharp spade was used to slice off the top, which was then thumped into the hollow. A very hot flat iron, drawn over the moistened area, gave a hard glazed surface, but easily broken when trampled on. A heavy old rag mat, which was unrolled before the hearth on very special occasions. A double wick paraffin oil lamp stood on the bare, well-scrubbed table, with a chair at each end. A settle on the window side, and a form, a seat without a backrest, for three or four persons on the outside. The old-type fireplace was similar to those found in most farmhouses at that period. An oven to the left, and the boiler with a brass tap on the right. Several cast-iron bars spaced about 2 inches apart horizontally to a height of 2.5 feet from the floor, except for the ash box at the bottom. The three top bars were collapsible and could be dropped downwards and outwards to hold a pot or pan at a lower level. The much-used herring roaster hung from the bars when a salt herring was fancied. According to the heat of the fire, the roaster could be adjusted by hooking it on a higher or lower grate bar. These fish roasters could be purchased from any ironmonger's stores, but often enough, the local blacksmith had no difficulty in forming a much stronger one over the curves of his anvil. There were the roasters with one, two, or three tiers, but I had never seen one to hold more than three. If a household consisted of more than three persons, then two such roasters were slung side by side on the bars. The menfolk found two of these two-eyed steaks about sufficient for a meal. It was necessary, in order to cook both sides of the fish, to turn them over. This was done by gripping the tail with one hand and the head with the other. A short lift and quick twist would turn them upside down. It was a gloomy winter Saturday afternoon when, at the age of 13, the two old bachelors required my assistance to thatch a small straw stack alongside the yard, bearing in mind that the Crofters were 70 and 68 years respectively, and although quite agile, on the shaking pinnacle of a straw stack holding an armful of thatch was not the place for those of such maturity to be. Perhaps it would be after 4 o'clock when the more heavily bearded younger brother went to the barrel in the shed and retrieved 4 salt-covered silvery fish and disappeared from view. Within minutes, a rich aroma fanned by a southwest breeze filled the air. Even the monstrous pig in the sty gave several harsh grunts and poked his snout over the wall. My task complete, with a Saturday night ahead, I moved off. But a voice from the kitchen yelled, "Come here, come here. I've got something to show thee." Now thou've never seen the like of this, the very latest invention. It's a self-turning herring roaster. No more burning thee fingers, turning the things. Just press the lever with thee thumb, and over they go. Now thou've never seen the like of that now, have thou? He exclaimed. Well, I had to admit that I hadn't. It was the first I had seen. What joy seemed to shine from his face to think he had one device that the modern schoolboy hadn't seen or known. 2 herrings on each plate and an enamel teapot with some of the cold tea poured over the salt crinkled skin, I bid them good night, impressed by what the old boys had thought was the very latest design of man's scientific engineering. To them, a push-button herring roaster. They were fascinating, curious Manxmen who loved the reminiscence of their heritage. Going to work on an egg. Before 1940, hen eggs were not sold by the dozen, but so many for a shilling. If anyone went into a shop and asked for a dozen eggs when they were 14 for a shilling, the grocer would have difficulty in charging the correct price. For by the dozen, that would make them 6/7 of a penny each, and few people would understand those figures. In the late 1930s, I was collecting, at the peak period, 510 eggs a day from the nests of free-range hens, the peak laying period being between the 27th of March and the 10th of April, October being the lowest. It was the general practice not to keep the eggs more than 3 days old. This was becoming very difficult, as the local market was more than saturated. Almost 2,000 eggs had accumulated, packed in wooden cases holding 30 dozen or 360 eggs each case. It was at least 2 months before the visiting season would begin in June. So, placing 5 cases in the Austin 7 van, I set off on a determined mission. Amos Collister knocked on the side of the car and wished me luck. I visited almost every town and large village on the island. My first call was Castletown. One tradesman said he would take a few at 20 for a shilling, which was out of the question. Holmes the baker and confectioner was a much better offer. He would take 1,200 at 18 for a shilling, stating that he had a large oak barrel that would hold that amount preserved in water glass. This offer, not proving satisfactory, a hasty move to the private hotels and merchants in Douglas was most disappointing. No one seemed the slightest bit interested at all. Poultry keepers and farmers throughout the island were confronted with a similar plight, having oversupplied their regular customers. Ramsey and the North seemed to have an even greater surplus. So, in desperation, it was back to my best offer from Holmes the baker and confectioner in Maloo Street, Castletown, when, after some deep consideration, agreed to take 5 cases at 17 for a shilling. Later in that year, war was declared, and the inevitable changes soon took hold. No one knew how long the war would last, but we were told not to plan for a supply for the visiting season the following year. In consequence, the demand for eggs and dressed poultry diminished. The rising price of grain made it unprofitable to feed hens. It was stated at that time that people were mixing a quantity of sawdust with the crushed corn in the hoppers for the birds, though I have never actually seen it being done. In fact, I feel sure that if pine dust was used, it would flavour the eggs. But it was a known practice to put ginger in the food during the cold weather to increase the egg output. In the late winter of 1941, just over 2 years after selling the eggs at 17 for a shilling, I purchased 2 from Clark's Ballygarrigan Jerby for 1 shilling, or 6 pence each. Even then, they were reluctant to part with them. In the mid-1920s, the hen egg had a different value. On a Sunday afternoon, immediately after dinner, we would oil our push bikes for a jaunt to the north of the island. And although losing our way in the maze of roads, we would always land at that delightful spot by the shore between Jerby and Andreas called the Len. In the front room of a cosy little cottage, a cafe they called it then, though some people called it an eating house, we sat down to an afternoon tea, which consisted of a boiled egg, a large pot of tea, a big plate heaped with bread and butter, and a bowl of gooseberry jam, all for 6 pence. On later visits there, we were having 2 boiled eggs with the meal, for 9 pence. Our enormous appetites had forced a price rise for the generous lady. As we were about to mount our dropped handlebar machines for the homeward trek, an old man, leaning on the garden gate by his thatched cottage, boldly exclaimed, "Why didn't you get high handlebars on your bikes? You look like a churner drying on those things." I suppose he was acquainted with the penny farthing in his day. Whatever the price An egg has 2 ounces of goodness packed tightly into a shell. The Margaret Garden and Billy McGain. Perhaps it is not with nostalgia that we think of unemployment in the mid-1920s. For then, young persons clamored for jobs that they were not suited for, while others failed to find positions that they were more fitted to. There was little or no expansion in the building trade. Therefore, apprentices to the kindred trades were not required. And the tourist industry was a short seasonal one, leaving one without work for the greater part of the year. One of the more permanent jobs was that of hiring oneself to a farmer for the 12 months. This was useful in some cases, for the trend was for bigger families living in small houses. So when the boys reached the age of 14 or so, hiring and living in on the farm was some relief for the parents, though the wages was generally poor, with little prospects of achieving a greater status in life. There was another outlet for a fortunate few, who were inclined to be a bit more ambitious in their outlook. They thought of sailing the wide open seas and dreamed of the big ships powered by steam visiting foreign ports, then returning with a pocket full of money. But this was the actual situation from one who knows. At this period, there was the youngest son of a local farmer who took to the sea, but after a short term returned, no doubt, like the prodigal son, remembered the comfortable bed, the evenings by the log glowing fire, and the bacon and eggs. So fascinated was he with riding the rolling waves that his every conversation would be about the glories of sailing. So constant was Percy's topic on ships that they called him Skip, short for skipper. He convinced me that going to sea was much more rewarding and permanent for an enterprising lad than farming or casual labour. Percy spent many joyful evenings instructing how to box a compass, splicing ropes, making various knots, the bowline, the barrel hitch, the reef knot, half hitches, are some that have not been forgotten. It was now the late spring of the year when I approached the Isle of Man Steam Packet Company for a job. Though I had made three desperate visits to their offices and attempted to convince them of my interest and prepared for hard work, that I could read a compass, splice a rope, and secure knots, it was of no avail. Not even a stoker or trimmer was required. Then, apologetically, he informed me that they had a waiting list as long as his arm. That night, I informed the skip of my disappointment. "Never mind," said Percy. "I know a skipper in the Port St. Mary. His boat is tied up in the harbour now. We'll go down on Saturday night and have a word on him." 7:30 on that lovely Saturday evening, we cycled down the port. Then, strolling along the breakwater, we encountered a short, rather stocky man. "This is Mr. Billy McGain, voiced Percy. He is the skipper of the Margaret Garden. Here is a young fella that's looking for a job on the boats. And we were wondering whether there's an opening for he'd get a good ground on the Margaret, he went on. Billy the skipper looked me up and down. Yes, he said, I'll give him a start. I'll let you know when the boat is ready. She'll be having some repairs that will take about a week or two. What will I need in the way of provisions, I required? Nothing. Only get 2 corn sacks and stitch them together and pack it tight with straw for thee to lie on. There were 2 sister ships plying from Port St. Mary, the Lily Garden and the Margaret Garden. One was under the control of Tommy Kane, the other by Billy McGain. They were sailing vessels of the schooner type, depending on sails for their journeys, but had a small auxiliary engine used to raise the anchors, draw the winches and windlass, or assist in moving the vessel in calm waters. The seaman's accommodation was very scanty. A straw mattress on a narrow form in a recess like a cupboard, which was called the Green Fields. The cooking of food was on a small type of low combustion stove using coke. Sometimes a lump or two of coal made it burn better. A 6-inch tin pipe from the bogey, as the fire was known, went up between the masts. When, in rough weather, at every dip of the bow, puffs of smoke caused by the downdraft would emerge from the bogey, to the discomfort of anyone needing a sleep. There were 2 other sister ships of a different class which frequented and visited the port. They were the Progress and the Harkaway. The Harkaway may be remembered by the older Castletown inhabitants as she lay between the bridge and the Castletown side or the castle side of the harbour. The Progress finished its days rotting below the warehouses in front of the Albert Hotel, Port St. Mary. It was owned by Ned Cubbon of Serby. Portlamurra presented a grand sight of sailing vessels in those early days. The hard-working schooners, luggers, nickies and nobbies, with their sails flapping in the breeze, are now just pictures in memorial albums, like this little poetry recalls. From the Western Isles to Baltic, from Shetlands round the land, from Pentlands down to Wearside, our vessels often ran. Around the Clyde and Mersey, or Bristol Channel way, our Portlamurra schooners went trading in their day. We boasted some fine vessels, and they numbered quite a few, but their names are now forgotten, like many of their crew. 'Twas grand to see them sailing, yards square and running free, perhaps making for the harbour, their folks once more to see. But our harbour now is empty, for the days of sail are gone. And should you meet a schooner man, perchance you may find one, he'll tell the story proudly, though his eyes be full of tears, of the Portlamurra schooners and the glory of past years. Market Day. The country ladies with ostrich-feathered bonnets and long wide skirts that stood behind stalls in the old Douglas Market are long past memories. Saturday was market day, and a long day too for those females who lived many miles out of the town. They trudged for 2 or 3 miles to reach the railway station. Muddy rough lanes and dusty tracks, labouring under 2 big baskets packed with butter from the weekly churning and layers of fresh eggs separated by a cloth or bits of paper. Dressed fowls, even bunches of garden or wild flowers, were conveyed on the arms of those housewives as they came in 2s and 3s from the 4 corners of the compass, relieved to drop their burdens on the waiting room floor. There were a few more fortunate ladies who arrived at the station gates in pony traps, the husbands or farm labourer unloading the goods onto the platform, while she secured the ostrich-feathered bonnet by a long, sharp hatpin. The little Manx puffing engine, towing 6 carriages, gave a long blast on the hooter, as if warning the waiting passengers to drag out the variety of wicker baskets. It was Tre the Lure, time enough to get the parcels aboard. Dick Nelson, the guard, pleasantly assisted with the unloading of the heavier goods. Then, with all doors securely shut, he waved the all-clear flag as Davy Doe responded with a sharp blast on the whistle. Then, ever-increasing puffs of smoke, like a bank of mist obscuring the forward coaches until it disappeared under the Ballochagan trees as it sped eastward towards Douglas Terminal, where another 6 miles of basket slogging awaited those passengers. The hard work neither started nor finished there, for 2 or 3 days previously, the chickens and ducks were being plucked, dressed, and may I add, properly dressed, not the slap-happy method by which many can be seen roughly cut and tied up in several places by string and often shoved into a polythene bag, twisted at the end, embedded with a piece of sticky tape, today. No, yon ladies had to display their handiwork, and woe betide them if those wooden skewers didn't hold the bird firm and the giblets weren't correctly aligned on each wing. Then again, the bitheg, that is the cream ready for churning, would be poured from the crocks into 1 or 2 types of churns, common at that time. One was called the flapper churn. A funny shape. It was oval, quite wide at the bottom, narrowing to the top. A glass peephole in the lid to indicate the progress of the milk breaking. A shaft went through the centre of the churn with a cranked handle on one side. The flappers, or impellers, 2, 3, or 4, were spaced around the shaft inside. Thus, when this oval oak box-like implement with brass bands around it stood on the floor, the operator would be slightly stooped to turn the handle, which could be almost continuous for 1/2 to 1 hour. The other, and a newer model, was the barrel churn. Some folk called it the end-over-end. Others knew it as the daisy churn. It was simply a highly polished oak barrel swinging between two trestles. Again, operated by a cranked handle, fastened at the center. The tight-fitting lid secured by clamps at the top. When this barrel was one-third to half filled, the cream would slosh from one end to the other at each half turn of the handle, which was proved to be an easier and quicker way of making larger quantities of butter. The butter then lifted from the churn and placed in a large dish called the mailer, where any trapped water or air bubbles would be pressed out. The addition of a very liberal amount of fine salt had to be evenly distributed throughout the whole mass, then weighed off into pound and half pound pieces, each portion being placed onto uncrumpled, greaseproof paper and finally decorated on the sides and top with designs made by lightly pressing a fancy curved clapper of a sycamore wood, then placed in the middle of butter baskets for transport. The packets were not fully wrapped, but left slightly open at the top, which could be easily opened to show the undisturbed prints that were on the top. The eggs, both hens and ducks, were carefully washed and packed in layers on the Friday. Only the best would do. A feeling of pride in each job with a touch of rivalry. It was a sore point if someone said that Mrs. Kelly's produce was much better than Mrs. Convig's. There wasn't such a thing as shop closing time. The market stallholders would be there until time for their last train home, if they hadn't sold all what they had taken in. The thought of taking back two or three dressed chickens or some packets of rich Manx butter was not a pleasant one. There was no such thing as fridges and freezers. So, on that last hour of standing market on a Saturday night, one would find bargains. Dressed chickens, sixpence and ninepence each. Butter as low as twopence a half pound, with eggs reaching more than 24 for a shilling. But this wasn't the general rule. Many stallholders in that market had cleared the lot by 11 in the morning and would be enjoying some personal shopping or sightseeing in the afternoon. The sales in the main were determined by the time of year. For example, there was a greater demand when visitors came. Again, one rarely did wrong by having plenty of dressed fowls near Christmas. It wasn't all sunshine for those farmers and crofters who stood market. Or should I say, it was the sunshine that brought problems. Those hot, thundery times when the butter was so neatly packed, the heat caused it to melt. Making it run was the phrase. So the baskets with the contents were lowered down the well, not quite touching the water. And it was amazing how firm and cool when wound up immediately before transporting to market. The big fish that didn't get away. There's been some fine fish landed at the ports, harbours, breakwaters, jetties, and also on the rocks around the sea-lashed coast of the Island of Man. One lad claimed that he hauled ashore a 7-foot conger, But just imagine standing inside the bottom jaw and hacking away at a tooth on the upper jaw with a blunt pocket knife of the biggest fish that ever came ashore on the coast of this island. It was a monstrous fish, weighing over 80 tons, but it wasn't caught by hook and line. Two young men who were walking along the east side of the Langness Peninsula in search of driftwood looked down onto the pebbled strand of a rugged, lonely inlet known as the Horseshoe Gullet. And there, lying on its side, was a large whale, its mouth wide open, its head resting on the gravel at high water mark, the tail fanned out and just moving slightly by the roll of the incoming tide. News of this unusual find soon spread some miles around, which brought sightseers by the score to witness an occasion that had never been seen before, and certainly not likely to have been seen again, at least not in our lifetime. The date, as far as I can recall, was 1925. I cycled along the path to the old Langness Farm buildings, parked my bike against the stone wall, and walked over to the other side of the peninsula. It was an inspiring sight to stand on that grassy bank and gaze in astonishment at a massive creature of over 80 tons. No local person had ever seen a whale before, and it would be interesting to know, has anyone seen one since? I slid down the bank to examine closely why it should be there, and to run my hand along the tough skin on the body. Even the flexible point of the tail was very heavy. Several young men were peering into the throat, while one or two tried hard to cut a piece of a tooth for a souvenir, which attracted me to do the same. But my blunt pocket knife was no match for the formidable feeders. Some days later, this marine specimen was towed from the rocky inlet to the more accessible strand at Derby Haven. At this point, the monster was gradually winched onto two low, flat wagons, having broad iron wheels. It took two steam traction engines of the type used in conjunction with the threshing mills to haul this foreign fish. The engines belonged to Shimmons of Lower Sulby, Onchan. What a fascinating sight as those two puffing engines towing each other, pulling the following flat-bottom trucks, the big creature wobbling above the springless chassis. Two volumes of smoke rose into the air as this spectacle rounded Ballasalla Corner and climbed the Glashan Hill en route for Douglas. It was often asked, why should such an ocean creature come here to find his last repose in a quiet cove on the coast of this island in the Irish Sea? But a report later stated that it had been hit by a ship, then sought a place of refuge to recover, which we now know that blow was fatal. The skeleton of that memorial fish of 55 years ago now occupies a large area in the Manx Museum. And when you view it, Try to imagine a young man standing on his bottom jaw, attempting to remove a little souvenir from the top.